Hello and welcome to the latest episode of Nevermind the Bar Charts, and a particular welcome to our many new subscribers. Our subscriber numbers
are we up to three now?
No, we're deep into double digits now.
Oh wow! It's like a Lib Dem polling.
Exactly,
search.
We can begin to dream of topping. In fact, we have topped 20 subscribers. But no, genuine, very many thank you to everyone who listens. It's lovely to see several hundred listens to each of our episodes, which, for better or worse, encourages us to carry on doing them.
Tough luck, listeners.
Thankfully, the Liberal Democrats have nicely served up a bevy of positive stuff for us to talk
about. I know,
about.
I was trying to think, because the last time I was elected...
I should just say to listeners that Stephen has about four empty cups of coffee in front of him. So when he says, I'm trying to think, he's literally true.
It is powered by caffeine this morning. I think the last time I got elected was about the last time the Lib Dems had an unvarnished good result in a local elections, and that was in 2004.
You're older than you look.
It's not cause and effect, by the way. I'm not saying because I got elected that night that that's why that happened, but because, of course, that was post-Iraq. Mm. And then we had the 2005 general election with locals, and that was slightly disappointing. And then, of course, Cameron surge took over, and then, of course, it's coalition. So it's for lots of Lib Dem members, this will actually have been probably the first set of local
really
election
good
results
set of elections,
that they can think of.
And I guess one slight digression that's worth pulling out from that is people often forget that in many ways the Lib Dem decline set in pre-2010. Yeah. Certainly if you look at the Liberal Democrat local government base, it sort of grew decade after decade, really, with some ups and downs, but to a peak in about the mid to late 90s. And then it stagnated for a bit under a decade before then starting to decline several years before we went into coalition, which is one of the reasons why I bang on about how we need to rebuild the party in a way that's different from simply mirroring the past, because we need to learn about more than just coalition in terms of what has worked but also not worked in the past. But back to happy news.
So if you want to give us a little bit of a recap, obviously we're talking a couple of weeks more or less after the local elections, but just, I don't think Lib Dem listeners at least will be able to get enough of some of the figures local elections.
I think I could just say the number 704 on loop for 3 hours, and this probably would be our most listened to, most popular, best rated episode. So 704, I believe, was
the number.
What number
does that refer to, Mark?
The number of net Liberal Democrat gains. So largest number of gains the Liberal Democrats have ever made in a round of council elections, larger than the Alliance ever managed. And in fact, I think if you stretch back, it's just possible there might have been something like a post-Alpington year where the party topped that back before people kept really systematic records. But it's pretty likely that is 704 is the best result for Liberal Democrats stroke Alliance stroke Liberals since before the Second World War.
Hurrah! Hurrah for that.
Hurrah! Also quite promising was the Lib Dem share of the vote. The BBC figure, which is the nicest one and therefore obviously the one that we're going to say is the most rigorous this time around, had the Lib Dem equivalent national share on 19%. For people who don't know what equivalent national share means, is it's not all of the country was up for election, not even all of England was up for election, and Scotland and Wales obviously had a few council by-elections, but not generally elections. So what the BBC does is they take the votes that were cast and then extrapolate from that to what the share of vote would have been if the whole country had been up for election, and taking into account the variations of which sort of areas were up and not up. So they put the Lib Dems on 19%. Thrasher and Rawlings, who do the same sort of calculation but with a very different methodology, they put the Lib Dems on 17%. It's always reassuring that two different methodologies come up with roughly the same answer. The BBC's 19% was out and out the best Lib Dem result since the collapse at the beginning of the coalition years. Thrasher and Rawlings actually had the Lib Dems on 18% in 2017, but again, 17% this time, 8%, then definitely back up to much, much better than the long stretch of coalition years.
Just in terms of expectations, because I saw on your blog that you'd written about, you know, in your visits to various
www.markpack.org.uk.
Excellent. I'm sure people didn't know it otherwise. Then you've been various parts of the country, and one of the comments you made was that you were being sent to help out in wards which were stretches for the Lib Dems.
Absolutely.
And that was where you were getting a sense that actually things were looking good. And I remember in the last podcast I was, you know, being slightly doom-mongery because we've had lots of predictions of Lib Dem breakthroughs and recovery before, and they've not quite come to pass. This one did. So what do you think was different this time, from your experiences out on the doorstep, that hasn't been happening for the last couple of years?
Well, I guess one very boring explanation is that this is the one year in the four-year cycle which has by far the largest number of seats up for election. So although this year was a fantastic success, that headline number is slightly magnified by it having come in the year that was the peak year for number of seats up for election. Now, I did notice somebody commented on something I wrote a few days ago that, in a way, the figure, you know, it's slightly unfair to Tim Farron, in a sense, if you look at his local government record, because he had a good year and a not-so-good year in local elections when he was leader. His good year wasn't a year when as many seats were up for election. On the other hand, in Tim's case, his bad year was also not a year when so many seats were up for election.
So are these particularly kind of Lib Dem-friendly areas or not, or is it a bit of a mix?
Well, it's a bit of a mix.
You've got the Tory shires and you've got some northern Labour-controlled cities, all kind of part of the mix here.
I mean, overall, the seats, the wards up for election were slightly more Leave than average. About 54% Leave in the referendum rather than 52% across the nation. So in that sense, I wouldn't say it was particularly, you know, a massively Lib Dem favourable area. What it was, though, was that it was a lot of seats where sort of Tory seats in southern England or sort of more rural, more prosperous bits of northern England, a lot of Tory, such Tory seats up for election, where the Lib Dems still had a little bit of a presence. And one of the things that some of the analysts really highlighted was how, where it was the Lib Dems were still a clear second, Lib Dems did fantastically well. There were also some great breakthroughs elsewhere, but it was certainly having had just enough of a local party survive.
So was it, I guess looking at reasons for Lib Dems doing well this year compared to the last couple of years post-Brexit, is it partly a Brexit backlash against the Conservatives? Or is it the Lib Dems losing the toxicity of association with the coalition, if that ever particularly existed? We talked before about the fact that maybe the Lib Dems were invisible.
Spoiler, readers, it didn't. That's a slight exaggeration, but for any new listeners, as we have many new listeners.
Go on.
The key figure to remember here is that YouGov did some polling, which is matched by other research, but this one YouGov poll captures it really nicely, where they asked people a couple of years after coalition, firstly, do you think the Lib Dems were right or wrong to go into coalition? And secondly, if you think they were wrong to go into coalition, have you forgiven them? So the people who thought the Lib Dems were wrong to go into coalition and hadn't forgiven them was around one in four of the electorate. So in amongst that will definitely be some former Lib Dems and all of that.
And probably in some of the seats such as Cambridge, Oxford East, etc.
Absolutely. Where, but overall, it's only one in four. Yeah. And obviously a good chunk of those are, for example, sort of hardcore left-wingers who would absolutely hate the Lib Dems and never, maybe once would have voted Lib Dem post-Iraq War, but were not really ever part of a sustainable Lib Dem coalition. So definitely there was big damage to the party in the coalition years. But this idea that the brand was massively tarnished, I think, is hugely over.
And it was more the invisibility of Lib Dems and the feeling that they hadn't achieved anything by going into coalition. And so we're all at that reason. So back to my question.
I will return to that, though, when we come to...
Is it how far is it a kind of benefiting from Brexit backlash among Remain-inclined voters? Or is it the Lib Dems simply becoming party of protest? I hate that phrase because, actually, I think all parties are parties of protest. People vote for the Labour Party because they don't like the Conservatives. They vote Conservative because they don't like Labour. All parties are, to an extent, a reaction against whoever's in power. But the Lib Dems are often labelled a party of protest conveniently. So to what extent is it Brexit? To what extent is it just a reversion to the mean of benefiting from being the leading party in opposition in some parts of the country?
It's probably a bit of all of those factors. I think if you look at the correlation between Lib Dem share of the vote and how Leave or Remain in area was, there is a bit of a pattern that the more Remain in area is, the better the Lib Dems did. That pattern is strongest if you look at the vote share changes over the last 4 years. There's definitely been a shift in the Lib Dems towards doing better in Remain areas. That shift has probably taken place a little bit more over the earlier part of that four-year period rather than the last 6 months. So it's the stalemate in
and
Parliament is probably not the cause of that.
Probably there's some degree of correlation between Leave voting areas of the country not having been particular strengths of Lib Dem support in the past as well.
Yeah, so there is that organisational factor, and in particular, if you look at where people have joined the party, the people have joined the party in the last few years predominantly in Remain areas, and the organisational capability that comes with that then magnifies that that the effect of it being a more Remain and therefore more favourable to the area.
Because I was just looking at some of the data, and so in areas that voted 55-60% Leave, the swing to the Lib Dems was about 3-4%, which was fractionally below more Remain voting areas, but not that much different. It was pretty much across the board until you get to 60% plus Leave voting areas, which I'm guessing are not natural Lib Dem areas in the main.
Yeah, so I think there's both a sort of an organisational capacity issue there, and where have we got members, where have we recruited new members. There is also a bit of underlying views amongst voters. The public is beginning to finally notice the Liberal Democrats are anti-Brexit, which, I mean, I often joke that people say being a single-issue party is a bad thing. Actually, no, when you're a small party, being a single-issue party is progress, that people actually associate something with you.
As Change UK are helpfully proving for us.
I think the other factor that we simply don't know is, even in Leave voting areas, there are a lot of Remain voters.
Yeah.
When you put it in the context of the sort of level of turnout we typically get at local elections.
Yeah.
And actually, I did a calculation for Peterborough, actually with a forthcoming Peterborough parliamentary by-election in mind, where, and this is just a very sort of Peter Snow type for a little bit of fun calculation, but if you look at how many people voted Remain in Peterborough at the referendum, overall the constituency voted Leave, but you look at how many Remain voters there are, you then look at what sort of turnout you typically get in a parliamentary by-election and how many votes you need to finish a strong second or even better in a parliamentary by-election, there are more than enough Remain voters for it to be possible to do exceptionally well.
Well, this is the argument often made by Labour Remainers, isn't it? That there's this view that's out there, particularly, I guess, on the Corbynite Lexit left, that Labour has to face both ways because it can't afford to lose its Leave voting areas, particularly in the north. But of course that does ignore the fact that even in the most Leave voting areas you probably had a third of voters at least voting Remain.
Yeah.
And many of those will have voted Labour at those elections. And so there's a real risk for them that by facing both ways they're pleasing neither side. And it's a risk that the Lib Dems have deliberately avoided by picking a side. I guess in the same way that on Iraq there was a risk, but the Lib Dems picked a side in the end. And you're seeing that sense of perhaps of benefit of whether people like the view or not, at least respecting that the party has a firm view and they know where they stand, which has often been the argument against Lib Dems in the past, that you're never quite sure what they stand for.
Yeah, and I think it's worth remembering that although the Liberal Democrats have very long been a pro-European party, it is a little bit unusual for us to be so out-and-out European without wanting to caveat it in some way that it's, oh, what about Norfolk, and what about Devon, and what about Cumbria, and what about the... And this is partly why it's a point you've often picked up on, you know, when we talked about this in the past, even when, in the, you know, when we've been quite pro-European in the past, there's often been a... But say we'll have a referendum about it add-on, which pro-Europeans have been able to be happy with, to say, well, look, we're campaigning for something pro-European, but those in more Eurosceptic parts of the country have been able to hang on, but look, it's okay, we're not going to force
it on
you.
Don't worry, we're not that European.
We'll give you a vote. And what I think is striking is how little sort of a backlash is would be maybe putting it too strongly, but how little pushback there is in the party now compared to similar debates in the past, where there is much more willingness to be out-and-out pure European.
Well, it's part of the kind of polarisation, I guess, of political debate more generally in the country, that people are now having to pick one of two sides which aren't actually related to Conservative or Labour, left or right.
Exactly,
it's much more complex than that now.
I mean, there is a little bit of pushback. I mean, we talked before about Norman Lamb's comments about how uneasy he was about the party's strident pro-Europeanism. The party launched its European election campaign shortly before local election polling day. And again, there was a little bit, there was some complaints from some quarters about how dare the party be talking about Europe ahead of a local election polling day. And then I think that reflects how the other element, going back to sort of what caused the tremendous results, the other element in that was particularly in parts of Northern England, really bad, you know, poorly run Labour councils with Labour councillors who are massively out of touch with their wards.
Sunderland being the kind of epitome.
And this, I mean, people sometimes use the phrase protest voting, but I think there's something a bit more glorified, a bit more admirable about if you have a ward that's been neglected by the council, that's been neglected by its councillors, and you then have a political party that comes along, thankfully in this case the Liberal Democrats, that starts really communicating with voters, taking up issues on the behalf of voters, etc. Now, it's true that maybe if it were a group of three super keen UKIP activists, the party, the ward would have voted UKIP rather than Lib Dem. So there is a
big upsurge in independents getting elected precisely for that reason.
But it is more than just protest. I think it's quite easy for political pundits in London to be a little bit snobbish about voters responding very powerfully to a long-running feeling of neglect by voting for somebody credible who will kick out the people currently in power. Yeah. That's much more than protest. That's, in part it's protest, in part it's maybe even a plea for help, but in part it's also a recognition that, hey, there are some people who are willing to put the effort in to make our lives better.
In part it's democracy.
Exactly.
Just in terms of, you talked about tremendous achievements, and we've done that. I feel like I ought to be at least some voice of caution and rain on the parade just a little bit. So, I mean, just three things, I guess, that were less positive. One you've already mentioned, which is that the vote share, whilst up on previous years, is still well down on where the Lib Dems were. I mean, take 2006 or 7, when the Lib Dems at the time were said to be in turmoil. Charles Kennedy had just been forced to quit, and Cameron was on the surge, Lib Dems in disarray, and still the party got 26-27% at that time you've also got the number of seats contested, which is something I know you bang on about, that every Lib Dem area should be putting up a full slate of candidates wherever possible to give people the chance to vote Lib Dem, and that happened in 53% of wards this time, compared with two-thirds again going back 10 or 12 years. So you've got these overall a great picture on the night, but nonetheless it's not full recovery even back to where we were 10 years ago. And of course, 800 seats under Vince Cable, that's great, but of course 2,500 seats lost under Nick Clegg. So it's a kind of inch by inch recovery. It's not a complete turnaround, is
it? I mean, I guess depending on exactly what sort of measure you use, you could sort of say we've maybe done about a third of the recovery. I guess on vote share you could maybe argue, well, we've sort of gone from about 10 to 17, 18. If we were to do another 8 points, that would be back. So maybe it's halfway. Somewhere between, we've got between a third and a halfway of getting back to where we were before, and indeed we would obviously hope to do even better than we were before. So there is a long, long road still ahead of us.
Yeah.
That said, to have got between a third and a halfway back within a couple of years is pretty good. Pretty good going in many ways. It's worth remembering that there wasn't an immediate massive bounce back for the party once we were out of coalition. There was a huge surge in party membership, but on all the other metrics, it didn't suddenly bounce back really, really quickly. So in that sense, I think the speed of progress is pretty good. The fact there is still so far to go perhaps says something rather more about not just how badly coalition hit us, but how decline had set in pre-coalition as well, and therefore just what a big challenge there still is.
Yeah.
But third halfway there, it's more than one step forward, maybe two or three steps forward.
And what it does, I guess, is set up the party for the European elections, which, I mean, I remember we briefly mentioned it in one of our first podcasts, this idea of European elections, and wouldn't it be fantastic if there were some, because wouldn't that mean the Lib Dems had
poised? I think the way to describe that, Stephen, is long-term listeners will have heard it predicted here first.
Indeed, yeah. But at the time it seemed almost a joke, the idea that there would be European elections, and yet here we are.
Actually, just as a digression, those of you who remember how it was basically impossible to hear Stephen in our early pilot episodes, it makes
many listeners preferred it, I'm sure. Yeah,
we can claim basically that you predicted anything, and simply say to people, go and listen to the podcast.
Well, to be fair, to be fair, I predicted 703 net gains.
Yes, you were so close.
Not 704, so my powers of prediction weren't perfect. But we have these European elections taking place. 23rd of May, and what the local elections have done, of course, is give the party a huge fillip, a springboard into them. And I guess, on one level, what it's done is establish the Lib Dems, together with the Greens, to be fair, as the two main repositories of unabashedly Remain parties, and have eclipsed Change UK, the independent group, the Remain Alliance, whatever they are this week. Their claim that the Lib Dems just can't do it, and therefore we are the people who can plausibly become that safe repository of Remain voters. That's gone away now with those local elections, hasn't it?
I think there's a sort of a couple of, or maybe three sort of big mistakes it looks like Change UK has made. One is to think the Lib Dem brand is irredeemably tarnished, so to misinterpret. I mean, it's a very common thing that people say, oh, Lib Dem, you know, brand completely trashed by coalition. Even the Rory and Steve from Not Enough Champagne, my favourite left-leaning political podcast, they often say really good, you know, really insightful things that certainly make me pause for thought. But I think this is something they quite often get wrong as well. It wasn't really that the brand was tarnished; it was people felt the party was irrelevant. That was, and mm-hmm. I think Change UK sort of misinterpreted that as well. I think the second sort of mistake that Change UK have made is to underestimate the degree to which you. Getting the basics of political organisation right is actually really quite hard if you're coming from scratch. And maybe they underestimated that, or maybe they overestimated their own knowledge in that area, but they do seem to have struggled a lot with some of the basics. And one way of thinking about it is essentially they lack a Bill Rogers. Bill Rogers, mm-hmm. one of the members of the SDP Gang of
the
Four.
The fourth man.
Yeah, and the owner of the best political autobiography title ever in history, ever. 100% guaranteed. He called his autobiography Fourth Among Equals, which I thought was a lovely piece of self-deprecation, but reflected the fact he was normally thought of as the least well-known, the least important of the Gang of Four. What he did, though, bring, and I think Change UK really highlighted how it's easy to underestimate this, is some of that organisational nous
and understanding. Well, the thing that struck me about the independent group when it launched, other than wishing them well at the time, as I did on this podcast, was they didn't attract Lib Dem peers, Labour peers, or indeed Conservative peers.
Or indeed Lib Dem peers.
Lib Dem. So they didn't actually get any members of the House of Lords, as far as I'm aware, not publicly, not that I noticed coming across. They didn't get any councillor, or there were a handful of councillors who arbitrarily chose to upstick.
There's certainly a couple of former Labour councillors in Brighton, but few beyond that. Yeah.
So there wasn't that, and what that pointed to was there wasn't really a kind of network building up, and there did seem to be this sense that they could win through the air war, which has perhaps been disproven by experience, which when you are, you know, the fifth largest party in the Parliament, I mean, you know, well done and everything, but that does not guarantee you the first slot on News at 10 every night.
Yeah, and I think that was their third mistake, is they don't seem to have got enough different ways of trying to pull themselves into media and public attention. Mm-hmm. Now, obviously, they do have, and, you know, they may yet pull this off again with some further defections. You know, big political defections do really attract news and attention.
Tony Blair, like I said last time, they needed to land Tony Blair.
Or maybe not. Anyway, moving on from that. But they don't seem to really have had a plan B. You know, okay, if we've got one wave of defections, what then do we do to keep the momentum going if we don't pick up more?
Yeah.
I mean, for the Lib Dems, in a way, the local elections were plan B, was if we're not getting as much national attention as we want, you can use that grassroots campaigning infrastructure to hang on and then to carry on battering away, and whether it was the Richmond Park parliamentary by-election a couple of years back or the local elections this year, sometimes also achieve something that begins to get you back into the national picture. Or it can be through being really sort of scrappy and aggressive at chasing media coverage. Nigel Farage is quite a good example of that. So there are lots of different ways you can have...
Or indeed, you can attempt to get
public attention and momentum. What Change UK seem to have had is sort of nothing really beyond that initial hit.
Whereas the Lib Dems, the Lib Dem slogan of the European elections, you were talking about aggressively grabbing the media limelight.
Let's hope we're not going to get censored by Apple, iTunes.
So the Lib Dems have often actually had two slogans for an election campaign, normally because they couldn't decide at the top of the party which one to go with, and so you end up with Fair, Green and Prosperous for a New Britain, Renewal Now kind of melange.
P.S. Labour can't win here.
And where we work, we win. Kind of melange of disparate phrases strung together in the hope that people will like the sound of one of the words in them. This time we do have two slogans. One is Stop Brexit, which is the pre-watershed version, and then there is the post-watershed Bollocks to Brexit, which we will shorten to B2B. I mean, I came out as mildly against it in the sense that I don't like the general kind of coarsening of discourse. It sounds a bit pompous, doesn't it? But, you know, I just don't like that sense of... it's the whole kind of language of betrayal and traitor and everything that's going on at the moment in politics. And I'd rather the Lib Dems were standing above that, when they go low, we go high kind of stuff. On the other hand, it's clearly been very, very effective.
Yeah.
And has grabbed the media limelight in a way that Change UK hasn't, and has stolen the march on them, and has led to this surge, it seems, in the opinion polls showing support for the Lib Dems. So definitely effective, whether or not I like it.
Yeah, and I mean, as you know, Stephen, when the microphone's off, I mean, bollocks to Brexit, it's quite mild by the language that you normally catch me using. So likewise...
Mark, potty mouth, pack,
exactly.
They call him.
It's not the language I would naturally instinctively reach for to use myself, but what you do need with political slogans is language that has a chance of sort of cutting through. And I was slightly amused to hear from a couple of fellow activists at the weekend about how they had been out campaigning on Saturday and people walking past had been shouting bollocks at them. And I did think that's quite a nice change. A few years ago, actually, we probably had the same experience as Liberal activists. With that
I thought
happening.
You said it
but
wasn't toxic, Mark.
It used
I thought
to be
you
a
said
bad
it wasn't
thing.
Toxic.
The passing socialist shouting
okay.
that out. But I think that does nicely illustrate how... Well, I guess it illustrates two things. One is the power of slogans that really catch attention and cut through. You know, take back control, build the wall, lock her up, bollocks to Brexit, mm-hmm. all very different
drain
in some ways, but there is also a certain direct clarity about them. I guess the other thing that illustrates is just how varied voters are, and therefore what, you know, a word that for some people is horrific, and for many other people is just completely anodyne.
Mm-hmm.
And there's also then a whole group of people, I guess, sort of in the middle of sort of, yeah, it's okay to use occasionally, but please don't use it when my children might hear. You know, there's quite a wide range.
There is Ofcom polling data, in fact, on the proportion of people who regard the B word as
do
offensive.
Throw in some data
So I think
here.
It's something like 32%
yeah.
Regard it as a strong swear word.
Right. So we're pitching for the 68%. So we can dream. Of,
I don't know
yeah,
whether on any canvas data... sheets in the future will have to mark up, you know, likely propensity to be offended by swear words
yeah.
that literature can
I do wonder, do you remember what the sort of demographic breakdown was of whether people found that offensive?
I'm guessing it would be older voters, but I
yeah.
don't know.
That would be my guess as well.
So older voters in the Tory shires
yeah.
perhaps get the stop Brexit
yeah.
leaflet.
But I wonder also whether older voters are likely to... I mean, overall, are more likely to be leave, so that whether there's
mm-hmm.
an extent to which the people most offended by this are people whom the slogan is not designed to appeal to. I guess the other question with sort of what people find offensive or not is there are two different ways that you can react to finding something offensive. One is to sort of regret slightly the choice of words but still enjoy the message.
Mm-hmm.
And the other is to just reject it out and
yeah.
out. And my impression is, at least amongst Lib Dems sort of leaning people who don't like the word, that it does fall into the former category, that not liking the word doesn't result in them rejecting the whole slogan and think this is just awful
yeah.
what the Lib Dems are doing. What it seems to do instead is result in them thinking, look, you've gone a bit too far, I sort of understand why, although I think you're wrong to have done so, which still leaves them very open to voting for us, and ironically also has resulted
yeah.
in probably paying more attention to us than they would have been in the first
place.
And I think
the argument that has most validity, and I've read the arguments about why the Lib Dems are being entirely right, because it gets the cut through with
mm.
the media and it does capture that sense of frustration,
mm.
Which is probably an understatement,
yeah.
that many Remain voters who would be Lib Dem inclined have, and you know, it really kind of gets to their guts. So I totally understand that perspective. Sundar Cutwalla from British Future,
mm.
Who is, you know, one of the kind of voices of moderation, from a progressive, you know, former Fabian Society General Secretary, you know, someone who comes from a leftish tradition.
Mm.
His point on it, which I think is worth bearing in mind, is how do Remain parties try and get majority support?
Mm.
How do they build that coalition
yeah.
of voters? How do they appeal to the people who did vote Leave? Because unless you do get some of them over, then you can't possibly win in the future. And also that if you're overturning the democratic mandate of that 2016 referendum, then you don't want to do it narrowly. You know, what if there is a second referendum, what you don't want to end up with is a 51-49,
yeah.
Well, either way, but you know, what you want to try and get to is a 60-40 at least.
Mm.
And that this kind of language is polarising. It's great for building that core vote for the Lib Dems. I mean, you know, well done and all that. But in terms of the strategic, longer-term vision of how you can actually reach out to voters and appeal and build that real majority for remaining, it actually is, it works against that.
Yeah, and I was actually giving a talk to a group of Lib Dems in Southwest London last night, and this very point came up, and I think the way I phrased it then was simply to say, this is a good slogan for the European elections, it's an awful slogan for a referendum.
Yeah.
And I think if you simply try to completely change direction between the two, that would definitely be problematic. But it is possible to be consistent whilst using quite different language and arguments, and consistent in the sense of being really passionate about the idea that Brexit would be massively damaging for the country, massively damaging for our public services, and the people who would suffer most are those who are poorest and most vulnerable. The people who would suffer most are not people like Nigel Farage, who, for all his desire to paint himself as a principled opponent of the European Union, quite happily takes his salary from the European Parliament and doesn't turn up. A really principled
Eurosceptic would have... gentleman amateur who has stumbled across elections for the first time in his 24-year-long political career.
A genuinely principled Eurosceptic would simply say, no, I'm not going to take my salary from the European Parliament. But no, he quite happily snuffles up all the cash that he can. So it is quite possible to be consistent in terms of being principled and forceful about thinking that Brexit is awful, whilst using different slogan and also, crucially, in a way, sort of targeting slightly different voters. Because part of winning a referendum will be about definitely mobilising and energising Remain campaigners, but also about then having to win over some swing voters in a way that the European elections is much more about the former and less about the latter.
So what do you think will happen? What's your prediction? Nail your colours to the mast of vote share. I mean, I don't know how it converts into seats. No one really knows, do they?
Where does one start?
Go on, with a number.
My favourite...
I got it right with 703
seats. My favourite baffling figure is one of the most recent polls for the European elections, but the Liberal Democrats on 15%. And there are three amazing things about this. One is 15% is bloody good, given where the Lib Dems have been, and in particular given we always in the past have done worse in European elections, in general elections. So 15%, wow, amazing. Second, that 15% is high enough to put us 5 points ahead of the Conservatives on that poll. That's, I mean, to be 5 points ahead of the Tories, but to be 5 points ahead of the Tories when you're only on 15%, that's going some.
Yeah.
And also, only 1% behind Labour.
Well, we're finding out what the Conservative core vote is.
Indeed. So it's known as the Brexit part. the current figures are all over the place. Yeah. They're completely wild. I do wonder if people in Labour and the Tories are not quite faced up to just how horrific those figures are for two reasons. One is, I think we saw this certainly a bit with Lib Dems in the run up to 2015, it's sort of only when you really see the ranks of defeated candidates that sort of opinion poll numbers quite convert into something with real emotional power quite often. But secondly, it's
like,
quite
when the Lib Dems were reduced to one seat last time from 11. So you just had Catherine Bearder as the lone
exactly. And then likewise in the general election, you know, the huge, you know, there was a sense of it only really hits you.
Yeah.
It only really becomes real.
Vince Cable, David Laws,
So I do wonder to what extent Labour and Tories are in for, despite a well-predicted shock, but quite a big shock when the results actually come through. The other is this question about why people are abandoning Labour and the Tories. Because in a way, a government being unpopular mid-term, that's not unusual. And then government being so unpopular it's down to 10% in polls for European election, that's very unusual. But it also seems to me, at least, that a large part of this is to do with people not just being fed up with their usual party because they think their usual party is a bit incompetent, but viewing their usual party as no longer having the values that they do. And that potentially is much more damaging in the long run. Because being a bit incompetent, well, you know, the economy taking a bit of a turn for the better, a change of leader, whatever, there are lots of ways of dealing with that. If you feel that your values and that party's values are out of kilter, that's a much bigger, much...
It is. And isn't the worrying thing that we then, you know, the European elections happen, and then at some point, probably before 2022, there will be a general election.
Yep.
And people are then going to find themselves boxed back in by the electoral system, which means that in most parts of the country, if you don't like the government, you're faced with the choice of voting Labour. So you find yourselves forced back into that two-party contest, even though all the elections in between show that the appetite for a two-party contest isn't there.
Yeah, well,
and obviously
that's the
thing about
first past the post, though, is first past the post is strong but brittle. So it acts as this really powerful funnel to force people into thinking in a two-party mentality. So Tory Labour across England, obviously slightly different now in Scotland, but it is essentially a, you know, SNP or a unionist sort of two-party system in a way that we still have in Scotland. You know, and likewise, you know, not a sort of a complete multi-party free-for-all in Wales either. So first past the post does act as this really powerful funnel to, you know, force politics into sort of a, it's either this lot or that lot.
Yeah.
But when it breaks...
Yeah, well, as when, the Canadian Conservatives found back
just,
in the 90s...
You get can get completely wild results.
Yeah.
And, you know, you look at some of, you know, some of the polling that has both Labour and the Tories on well under 30%. I mean, it's... What you say is has always been true, but you still think there's just a possibility we might now be in that, oh, and finally...
Yeah.
The system no longer copes, but not no longer copes in a way that a party gets a few million votes and hardly any MPs, Lib Dems, UKIP, etc., experience in the past, but in a way that is just so completely chaotic that actually the voting system changes.
Yeah. Well, that's something to look forward to, isn't it?
Absolutely. And we will be discussing in detail the many different ways by which STV counts can be conducted and whether the Irish method is the appropriate method for doing STV
don't,
counts.
Don't go away, voters, yes.
Obviously, listeners, Stephen knows that De Hont is not a form of STV. But thank you very much,
on
everyone.
That bombshell.
Thank you very much, everyone, for listening. Do subscribe to this podcast if you enjoy what you've heard, so you will get future episodes about roughly fortnightly. It seems to be that the rhythm we fall into. You'll get future episodes automatically appear in your favourite podcast app. And if you are on social media, you can find the podcast on Twitter, at Bar Chart Podcast, and you can find us on Facebook if you search for Nevermind Bar Chart. So do like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and as ever, do use those channels to send us your feedback. It's always much appreciated. So thank you very much for listening.